This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/MBO. Terms and conditions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. And this is something that I've been super stoked to give you guys. This is an update from Ukraine from Dr. John Quinn. John, if you would give us a quick introduction of yourself.
Okay, great. Yes. So my name is John Quinn. I practice emergency medicine, mostly in the UK and occasionally Ireland and further far forward. I have been fortunate enough to work on and off in Ukraine since 2014, supporting operations in one way or another in the pre-hospital environment. And I've also been fortunate enough to engage with partners and really subject matter experts in the prolonged field care, as well as in far forward medicine, and been able to engage right now currently with a NGO humanitarian organization that is providing support through the Ministry of Health of Ukraine. As with the current conflict, there's also a lot of interoperability with the Ministry of Defense as it relates to not only point of injury care, but also tactical evacuation care, role one and role two. This also includes critical care evacuation. That's been the last 2.5 months have been very challenging as it relates to point of injury care, tactical evacuation, and role one in country. I've kind of zigzagged throughout, providing mostly ground transportation as well as support services at the point of injury and tactical evacuation phase, and most recently in the role one. So that's sort of everything in a nutshell as it relates to the current conflict and the current state of play with the medical situation right now in Ukraine.
Okay, so you're definitely the right guy we need to talk to about this. So just from what I understand, really this conflict between Ukraine and Russia, this is nothing new. It's been going on for years and years. So I guess in roughly around the time of the Crimea, Ukraine seemed like they started kind of, I won't say modernizing, but put a lot of emphasis into training in things like T-TRIC and PFC, and kind of how did that transition kind of happen? Like what level of providers were taught what?
Sure. Yes. So there was a significant decrease in capability and capacity from around 2010, 2011 until 2013 and the onset of 2014 with the initiation of hostilities of the entire military medicine throughout the Ministry of Defense for Ukraine, a significant decline in reduction. And as the events unfolded in 2014 and 2015, there was a significant, as you rightly state, there was a significant upswing in T-TRIC by partner nations, by partner forces, by volunteer groups, and there also was a focus with prolonged field care. This was owing to anywhere between a 2 to 4 to 6, and in some instances longer hours of evacuation time to just get to a role one and occasionally to a role two. Ukraine, being in the climatic zone that it is, many months of the year, it's extremely cold. And even in the warm period, it's extremely cold. So this is detrimental to morbidity and mortality, as well as having access to pre-hospital medicine in a modern European state. So there were many challenges. There was a lot of focus on training. There were many organizations that provided training. There was a significant emphasis and focus and really trying to align with Department of Defense clinical practice guidelines, with partner forces and NATO clinical practice guidelines, not only at point of injury care and at pre-hospital medicine, but also everything all throughout the wheel of and the continuum of care all the way to rehabilitation. There was a lot of work groups, workshops. There was a lot of academic exchanges and university exchanges, and really trying to focus and push and drive that alignment into a NATO standard, into a very high clinical standard. However, as fighting decreased, interest and support started to decrease in some instances as well. There were many organizations that kept the long game and kept pushing and driving forward, but there were many others, and a lot of money dried up and a lot of budgets dried up as we pushed into 2016 and 2017 and 2018, despite subtle spikes of violence and spikes of incursions by Russian forces. It was really kind of at this steady state. And the focus on T-Tri-C continued. There was a lot of translation of a lot of very high-level clinical materials. There were still a lot of academic exchanges. However, focus did shift elsewhere in the world. And as things really started to build up in 2021, the emphasis started to come back, started to reorient. At that time, there were also a lot of surgeons, a lot of anesthesiologists, a lot of emergency medicine doctors that had about 5 years of continuous training, not only within Ukraine, but also outside Ukraine and with partner forces. And there were a lot of other continuous exchanges just to look at global health engagement in general as it relates to a lot of the back and forth with everything from pre-hospital medicine to rehabilitation, actually a significant rehabilitation program with findings that were published in 2019 and 2020 that were very helpful and very forthcoming with the successes of Ukraine with partner forces such as the United States, with their being able to get warfighters back to the battle. So that was sort of the gambit as it relates to exchange and build up. When it comes to building resilience, there were a few hiccups. There were a few difficulties with the legal restraints as it relates to what you can actually do in the pre-hospital environment. There were also hiccups and difficulties in the legal front as it relates to interoperability between Ministry of Health forces. So you're a doctor in the Ministry of Health, yet you want to provide health care to a Ministry of Defense person or another defense force person, and they had to overcome that challenge, and vice versa between MOD and MOH, being able to provide surgical capabilities, for example, in an MOH facility, and vice versa. Interestingly, when hostilities initiated, on March 5th, a significant sweeping reform bill was passed this year, 2022, for DCR and DCS, for damage control resuscitation and damage control surgery, as it relates to specifically blood and other surgical interventions required, really making it widely known that, look, this is legal, you can do this, and we want to encourage this. Now, that will require additional follow-up legislation, but they really came a long way, taking 3 or 4 or 5 years to be able to push some of these legal restraints, to be able to put the right tools in the right hands of the right people at the right time, and then being able to say, look, hostilities began on February 24th with this new iteration of violence, that is, and by March 5th, they were able to really enact some of it. In some instances, with translations, it's a bit difficult, but almost a copy and paste from some of the DOD CPGs, clinical practice guidelines. So that was very encouraging, although more, you know, still remains that requires to be done.
Yeah, I mean, of course, but I mean, something like just blood, there's a lot of countries, you know, all over the world that, you know, are afraid of doing anything like that. So that's amazing that you guys are in such a short period of time implementing something like that, and I'm very confident it's gonna save a lot of lives. But this the other training in T-Tri-C and PFC as well, you know, how is that translated? Like, is it are you seeing a significant increase in life saved?
Absolutely. Just to give you an anecdotal sort of walkthrough, if you look at it's inconsistent across the board, not to look at any geographical process or locations, but it is inconsistent. Some roll ones will have a Foley catheter, will have multiple thermal blankets, will have sometimes three levels of access. So, you know, two AC IV access points and a subclavian or other central line. Some will have induced intubation, so RSI. Others will not. Others will have absolute minimal access to this. Some will have cross-matched blood in a roll one, if you can imagine this, while others are looking really more at getting that access to O negative. So when it comes to morbidity and mortality, I can tell you right now in 2022, adherence to these core metrics for prolonged field care and these core concepts of really trying to stop that lethal diamond are adhered to in many locations, not all, and there's still obviously everywhere there's area to make all of our practice better, no matter what we're doing, no matter when we do it, but there is a significant reduction in morbidity and mortality. Anecdotally, in a 24-hour period, I transferred 14 red patients, polytrauma patients. All of them had received those interventions that I just described. And anywhere, there was sometimes a delay of 60 minutes prior to roll one. In some instances, there was a delay of 3 to 4 hours prior to a roll one. They received these interventions. And at 72 hours, and that's really the only visibility I have on those patients, there was no mortality to speak of. Now, I don't know what the 30-day is, and we won't know for some weeks, Tom. But at the same time, just anecdotally, if you look at that, just that snapshot of time, that very simple data point of a 24-hour period, adherence to those principles was followed and led to better outcomes.
Outstanding. Especially if you guys can figure out how to crack the nut on documentation, that's going to be enormous, I think, worldwide.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I obviously need to engage with additional partners, but we've really stuck with the TCCC card, and we've really focused on those efforts to make sure that is actually passed from point A to point B. The Ukrainian MOD have their own TCCC card. It's not a TCCC card. It's a clinical practice card. It's mostly for damage control surgery, and it's a bit, it's not so, I've introduced the TCCC card and the concept, and we end up basically bringing both of them through echelons of care. I do not have any feedback at the Roll 3. However, it would be great to get a better understanding as relates to documentation of that process walking through. We have it in both languages. We have it in Ukrainian and English, so that provider can document, and so that in down the echelon of care, if additional provider says, oh, wait, I need to understand what actually took place, there's some level of a continuum of care. But documentation is a significant challenge. I will say, as it relates to blood far forward, documentation is absolutely vital, and what we've been doing is just keeping the actual empty blood product bag and keeping that with the patient so that they understand this blood has actually gone into this patient exactly, and we're that's kind of ad hoc, that's not institutionalized, that's not part of an SOP, but we've just started to initiate that just recently, actually.
Perfect. So as this current situation is unfolded, what sort of things have kind of surprised you or I don't say taken you off guard, but have definitely risen to the top as something you didn't really plan for? Let's say let's start off in a positive way.
In a positive way, I am absolutely blown away with the amazing clinical care that our colleagues here in Ukraine are able to provide in an extremely resource-poor environment, as well as under extreme duress from logistical, kinetic activity, everything. They are able to move mountains. They have done extraordinary damage control resuscitation and damage control surgical interventions. They've been able to institute, again, the concept of guerrilla hospital, in that it's in the basement, it's in Cold War era bunkers that they initiate DCR, DCS. It's also, it's quite considerable, I think, being able to provide transport in completely asymmetric vehicles and being able to provide some level of care in an asymmetric vehicle. Four-wheel drive pickup, no problem. Armored, no problem. And it's really being able to maximize that resource. However, there are some shortcomings. I think it is rather inconsistent. You may have an excellent evacuation chain, an excellent continuum of care, and excellent support along each echelon of care. So at the roll one, and the roll two, and the roll three, and further in the rear. However, you may go to another location, not that far, slightly, maybe a different, just a different oblast, a different county, if you will, a different state, and you have an entirely different, maybe not as positive at all environment. So you may have significant challenges, and a roll one may actually be a parking lot and an abandoned kiosk, and that's categorized as the roll one. So you've got Joe's bringing warfighters that are injured to that location, receiving another into another vehicle. The others turn around, go back to what they was referred to as the zero line. They go back to engaged fighting, and then the other echelon takes them to a roll two, which may or may not actually function at a NATO defined roll two. So it's rather inconsistent at some locations, but I must emphasize the extraordinary interoperability between MOH and MOD and what they've been able to accomplish. I cannot put a finger on the morbidity mortality numbers, but I will say a significant reduction, and it really, really trying to prevent the absolute worst. So I'm very pleasantly surprised by that. Absolutely.
The last thing you want to hear when you need your auto insurance most is,
"Thank you for calling. Please listen to your list of 46 possible service options."
Which is why when you choose USAA auto insurance, you'll get great service that is easy and reliable. 24/7 online service for claims, access to roadside assistance, and more. All at the touch of a button. Start getting the service you deserve. Get a quote today. Ability to receive a quote depends on membership eligibility. Membership eligibility and product restrictions apply and are subject to change. USAA means United Services Automobile Association and its affiliates, San Antonio, Texas.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/MBO. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, I mean, that's especially in the middle of a conflict like that, it's incredibly difficult to maintain something that hasn't really been tested to the limits like you are now being tested. So, logistical problems are, I think, ignominious throughout conflicts like this. In a negative way, I guess, what sort of things, I guess, maybe other than logistics, which I think is pretty obvious, but things like wound patterns, war is gonna cause just injuries that you wouldn't normally see. Are there been any issues with things like that?
Slightly. I mean, in I'd say there's two layers. In pre-hospital medicine, when you study to be a paramedic, when you study emergency medicine, it's mechanism of injury, mechanism of injury, mechanism of injury. And a lot of the patients do not know what happened. There are a lot of blasts. There's a lot of percussive injury, a lot of TBI, and the cluster munition Grad rocket system, the MLRS, the multiple launch rocket system, is absolutely devastating. These weapon systems are just conventional warfare used in a hybrid and multi-domain battle environment to devastating effect. So there is a lot of frag that has very small entrance wounds, and it causes absolute chaos in the abdomen, in the chest, and in the extremities. And that was probably the case 65 years ago as well, based on different weapon systems. However, really having really focusing on that primary assessment, that ATLS-driven, that TCCC-driven primary assessment and reassessment. You're on a horrible road. You're traveling at a very fast, you know, rate with a very bumpy road, and you can really dislodge. You know, you had clots. You had clots, and now you've just shaken everything up, and now you're going to rebleed. And it was a very small entrance wound, and it may or may not have received adequate or appropriate pressure dressings at the time, and now you have rebleeding. And that is something that may sound very simple. Maybe it is very simple, but that is something that, you know, based on the weapon systems, it is a challenge. It's a challenge for first responders. It's a challenge for self-aid, buddy aid, and it's a challenge, you know, across the continuum of care, really being able to understand what you're actually dealing with. Additionally, a lot of traumatic brain injury, a lot. There are a lot of blasts. There's a lot of grads. There's a lot of artillery, a lot of really heavy long-range artillery being deployed on a 24-hour basis. And so there's a lot of positions that are getting hit, and a lot of walking wounded with significant TBI. You know, they come in walking wounded. They're obviously, you know, escalated rapidly, but nonetheless, they're significant TBI. Having access to a CT is something that, in my normal practice in the UK, I have easy access to a CT scan. Basically, anything I want to do at any given time, I have no CT scan. In some instances, when the power is out, I have no access to X-ray. I do have a very small portable ultrasound, which is helpful at times, but it doesn't solve all of the issues. So I think those are some of the challenges based on weapon systems. It is very difficult when you don't have a mechanism of injury, because the patient does not know what actually transpired. So that is a challenge. It's just something that, you know, we're used to being able to engage with patients and say, okay, what actually took place? And we can kind of, in our mind's eye, understand, hey, this is what happened. They fell, or this happened, or a detonation. How close? How far were you? What type of round was being used? And it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult to discern what actually took place, especially when the patient does not. No. So that's challenging. That's challenging clinically.
Yeah, that's going to be challenging for anybody. And even the students that I teach here, you know, it's really just a mastery of the basics and understanding how to assess. And even when you don't have that patient information, kind of understanding the things that could go wrong and where those high yield assessments, and then continuing reassessments over and over again. So that's nothing new.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see. So, I mean, I can only imagine, thus far, have there been any cases of really prolonged field care or very extended evacuation times that you are aware of?
Absolutely. I mean, it happens basically arguably with every patient. So the zero line point of injury, it can be anywhere from around 30 minutes to 60 minutes to 2 hours before we actually get to the tactical evacuation phase. So the point of injury care is initiated. And as that patient gets to an asset to be able to provide tactical evacuation care to a role one, occasionally bypassing role one and going straight to role two, that time has just been ticking. Access to blood in some locations, readily available. We can cross match, or I can really push for O negative for the purposes of time. Occasionally, we don't have access to blood. In fact, you know, blood is gone. We would normally have access. We have the tubing, but we don't have the blood, and that's a logistical challenge. And sometimes there's areas where they say, no, we don't want to do this. We don't want to provide blood until they get further through the echelon of care to a role three. And so that's a challenge, obviously, in dealing with you know, our colleagues in that sense. But that's, you know, as it relates to prolonged field care, there's having access to that tactical evacuation phase and into role one. I've seen a lot of the thermal blankets being used. I've seen a lot of attempts at IV access, also attempts at getting some tablets on board, you know, whether it's just antibiotics, some pain management, something to start the process. We really push, we really drive all of our partner forces that we're engaging with, we say, listen, get anything you can on board, something that is, and be great to get feedback. But, you know, being able to provide TXA IM when you don't have access, when you don't have IV access, and being able to say, actually, not only are we going to give you TXA IM, which is actually quite a few mLs, but we're also going to give you your antibiotic IM if you can't swallow, or if we don't think that you should be swallowing because you're going to be getting surgery in the next X amount of minutes. So starting this process right now in 2022, it is miles ahead where we were in 2014 and 2015. And there's an acceptance. There is training. There's a training in the local language. So people are discussing this. They understand. A lot of feedback from pre-hospital care providers of partner forces have stated flat out, hey, we know that this patient needed blood, but we didn't have access, or we are not allowed to do that in our space. So identifying the issue, saying, okay, well, we can't actually do this just now, but we understand that what we should be doing. Having access to a Foley catheter, very important intervention. We don't have, and I've seen more and more, we don't have a lot of access to basic temperature monitoring devices. So, you know, the little small $1.50 digital thermometers, we've gone through quite a few of them. It would be great if we had more access to the Foley catheters that you can monitor the temperature devices, although you know it has to hook up to the right monitoring system, and these sort of advanced processes. But back to what you were saying about basic assessment and basic processes, I think when it comes to just feeling your patient, putting your hand on the patient's chest for an hour and 30 minutes, so you're monitoring breathing in the back of a truck, and it's, you know, red light only, and being able to understand, are they sweating, are they not, et cetera, being able to really get a feel and a process, how is your patient actually doing? Is it actually too warm at this point? And where is the fluid? Is the fluid actually still going in? Are we still ahead of the curve or not? I think this is something that is still a challenge as it relates to the prolonged field care environment. But there is definitely challenges with time, and really it's we haven't been able to avoid. You know, no one controls the air in Ukraine, so you can't fly, and you're going to be on the ground. And security events being what they are, there are multiple issues with time and getting to the next echelon of care, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, I can only imagine, because that's definitely not been an environment I have been in. My environment, it was, you know, 30 minutes and they were gone. And I think you're 100% right. Just the laying of hands on your patient for an extended period of time is going to give you, you know, so much more information. You're going to have so much better feel, I guess, for lack of a better word, for that patient, understanding, you know, their compensation during those times.
Absolutely.
So I guess, you know, in your experience and having to deal with these prolonged cases, very imperfect type situations, what kind of principles have you formed, or core principles have kind of risen to the top as being more important when it comes to casualty care?
Well, I'm gonna go out on a limb. The first thing is, you know, as you learn in paramedic school, scene safety. So the safety of the provider. This sounds kind of academic, I suppose, but our own safety is obviously very important, and I think that is absolutely key. Obviously, all of us are willing to risk significant. Risk everything in order to provide levels of care. However, you know, being able to be wise about how we capture our patients, how we collect our patients, and really focusing on doing it wisely so that you can do the greatest good for the greatest number. Not going to be able to do that much if Grad rockets take out your entire convoy. So this is something that may sound kind of simple and basic, but it is something that has really I've become acutely aware in this environment, and we are under, you know, bombardment 24 hours a day in some of our locations. As it relates clinically, I think really being able to have everything on my chest and on my person and not relying on things in the vehicle, not relying on bags that I have to be schlepping in and out. I don't have the space for a lot of those bags. I don't have access to them, even if I do have them. But if I have it on my person, if I have it on my chest, the absolute vital, whether it's a pre-drawn medication or medications, or whether it's other simple diagnostic devices like a pulse ox and a temp probe when I have them, or whether it's an airway, being able to have that on my chest is absolutely vital, because I know that if I get thrown into a different truck or if I get thrown into the resuscitation or trauma bay of an alternate facility that I've only been at once or twice, I know what I have on my person. Even just having trauma shears on my person for the purposes of exposure, adequate exposure, of the trauma patient. I think this is something that is just reiterating constantly throughout the process. And, you know, your own PPE, whether it's gloves or a headlight or other PPE that you have to have, like a vest and things. I think this is, you know, and we have gas masks for chem bio events as well. And, you know, schlepping that around is a challenge in the back of an ambulance, but it's absolutely important. And I think this is something that, again, it sounds kind of basic, but I think it is really important, you know, when you're up against conventional weapon systems. This is not Iraq. This is not the Mosul operations. This is not elsewhere where there has been really austere and hostile environments. This is a very specific location with specific risks and threats. And the weapon systems, whether or not it changes the TCCC paradigm or not, we'll only be able to tell after a collection of massive amounts of data. But right now, as it sits, we can just apply the TCCC principles, maintain scene safety the best that you can, and your own safety, and have everything that you need to be able to provide this medicine at the right time in the right place. I think that is something that is that we're aware of here, you know, on an hourly basis.
Yeah, I mean, like you're talking about having the gear on you. So essentially, you're talking about a march belt, and guys are definitely very familiar with that. And then, you know, having other gear stashed other places. If you need to, you know where it is and you can get to it ideally, but at the bare minimum, have the ability to do March and TCCC on you, right?
Absolutely, yes. And I don't have any fancy stuff. I just have basically three or four different IFACs that I've just kitted out in their own. You know, one is an IFAC that's stuffed, and then the rest are you know, other bits and pieces that I have. And then, you know, just put all your gloves in one back pocket and other, you know, 4x4s in the other back pocket, and then and go for it. But yeah, exactly. This is exactly the type of you know, level of access that you need. And if I don't lose a pair of trauma shears in one day, then nothing has happened. So I go through trauma shears like coffee. So it's something that just being able to really replenish that, have access to it, and also encourage other providers to have similar equipment on them, so that you know what everyone can handle. And if your bag gets blown up, or if you don't no longer have access to your bag, you know, you have something that is at least on your person that you can at least initiate care. You don't want to get stuck in the chow hall and you've got nothing on you. You're like, I've got nothing, and here we go. This is we're off to the races, and I've got nothing. So you don't ever want to get caught out like that.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and I would, the only thing I would reiterate is if somebody is preparing their march belt, you know, set it up how you think you want it, and then you're going to have to just use it. Like, you know, I'm sure right now you're getting lots of practice using that belt, and so refining it over time. I would also say you're in dire need of a retention line if you're losing that many scissors.
Yes, that's a good point. I'll probably enact that this evening. That's a very good point. I've lost to it. And also people also say, oh, hey, just give me your trauma shoes for a second while I do the other leg, and then boom, it's gone. but yes. In fact, I mean, and just, you know, with the trauma shears, we were doing a thoracotomy on a patient, and trauma shears actually were utilized during this sort of intervention in the past, which is perhaps not, you know, best surgical practice. However, it was very effective. But yeah, I have to get on top of losing all these shears.
Right. There's only one thief out there. Everybody else is just getting their stuff back, right?
Right. Yes, that's right.
So, those are key lessons learned right there, or concepts or principles. I guess other than, your scene safety and having gear on you, what other lessons learned have you picked up along the way as far as maybe, dealing with specific MOI or what have you?
Absolutely. I think what you do before you get in a very challenging transport is absolutely critical. So spending an extra 7 minutes or 9 minutes prior to getting out of Dodge, as it relates to airway, as it relates to securing airway, as it relates to doing that final, when you in the back of a truck, you don't have full access. So you have to really be squeezing and pushing and everything else. But when you do have access to that patient, doing that head to toe sweep, that ATLS primary assessment, and being able to really know before you get into the darkness, hey, what am I actually dealing with, so that I know what I have to be looking at for the next 2 hours and 15 minutes on this horrible bumpy road with nothing but a red light, and it's super hot in the back because you're trying to make it warm for the patient. I think really spending that time for the tubes and lines and saying, what do I have? What am I dealing with? And which one do I think may pop first? Resecuring that, whatever that line is that you think is going to, drop first, and, really considering all these other interventions that you cannot do while you are en route. And in the event that you get stuck at a bridge or you get stuck at some sort of event of some kind, what are some things I can stuff into my pockets that I will have on me, whether it's another preloaded syringe of normal saline as a flush, because I've got loads of, I've got ketamine on me, or I have this or I have that, but can I flush it? And thinking about these sorts of very, very basic, very, very practical, very fundamental things are very important. I think as it relates to, airway specifically, so as it relates to catastrophic bleed, I think it's very important, just to go backwards, I think it's very important to put a tourniquet on a patient with a controlled hemorrhage. So controlled hemorrhage, I'm going to be going somewhere for 2 hours and 15 minutes, put a tourniquet on that patient. Do not apply the tourniquet entirely, no, but you place the tourniquet on so that when you reassess that, if you say, wait a second, I'm bleeding through this all of a sudden because I've been on this bumpy road for an hour and 45 minutes, you can easily twist the tourniquet and stop that straight away. I think that is very important to consider. Some people would probably say, no, it's not necessary. I think it's definitely necessary. I think something to consider, to really be able to do that way before you get into the back of the truck. As it relates to catastrophic bleed, as it relates to pelvic trauma, I think it's very important to preemptively put on a sheet. We don't have a lot of binders. Binders were gone in the first, 4 weeks. Every pelvic binder that you've ever heard of is gone. So I have no idea where they all are right now, but we just have sheets. So put that sheet on if you have any consideration of mechanism as relates to pelvic trauma. You don't have to necessarily put it on full bore if there's no evidence, but have it so that you can definitely consider. It's a lot easier to put it on prior to transport. As relates to airway, securing that tube is significant. And if you're bagging that patient for 2 hours and 15 minutes, which you may be doing, really, really have a focus. And if you can have a second rescuer, if you can have a second responder with you, really focus on clinical response to ventilation. Think about, really have that monitoring device, which is a simple pulse oximeter device, or a nice, beautiful monitor if you have access to that. If you have access to a vent, obviously a ventilator is excellent. But really being able to say, I need to secure this tube and I need to be focusing on nothing but this airway. As it relates to head trauma, I think it's extremely important to consider this with bumpy roads and what drugs you're going to be giving as it relates to pain and sedation. I think it's very important to consider ICP early on. We're seeing patients that are ages 17 to 60. So this is a different patient cohort. We're dealing with multiple cohorts of patients for the different type, different use of ketamine versus other sedation and pain management, when we have access to pain management, which I can chat on quite a bit if you have interest. But and then when it relates to breathing and circulation, just really anticipating that, making sure you have a back valve mask on you, and say, this patient has a completely patent airway, they have an isolated femur injury, they're talking to me, they may even be speaking in my own language. This is a bonus. However, I need to have on my person a nasal pharyngeal, an oral pharyngeal, preferably an endotracheal and the ability to intubate, but I know I need to have a bag valve mask. We're not leaving without a bag valve mask because I have no idea what's going to happen for the next 2 hours and 40 minutes or for the next 9 hours if I get stuck somewhere. And you really want to have that escalation of care prepared so that you're not sitting somewhere saying, gosh, I wish I had a bag valve mask and I wish I had a nasopharyngeal. I think from a lessons learned standpoint, this is critical. I think a lot of people have learned these types of lessons, but it's really acute when you have no access, when treatment is absolutely vital, and when some of these life-saving measures are indeed life-saving, and it's very simple measures. And when you're able to enact them and provide that level of support and care, which kind of comes across rather simple and basic for the advanced practitioner, but you're able to deliver your patient to the higher echelon of care successfully. And that's very rewarding, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I am incredibly happy you just got done saying that, because we're constantly preaching, prepare for transport, and creating a problem list, which will help you prepare for transport. And guys are so energized to get them onto transport, but they don't actually realize how much transport sucks. And you find space, vibration, light issues. It just makes everything so much more difficult. If you could just take a few minutes, look over your problem list, and then forecast ahead what are the things that can go wrong, and then prepare for all those things, whether that be, maybe I do the intervention now versus later. Maybe I, put the tourniquet, on very loosely on their leg, I have those things in place. Come up with plans, like actual plans, not just I have ketamine. It's I'm going to pre-draw, 100 milligrams or 500 milligrams, whatever it is, into a 10 cc syringe, and I'm going to, if they start becoming light, I'm going to administer, 1 cc or whatever it is. But come up with a plan, have all those things lined up, and know exactly where they are, because they are on your person. You're going to have such a much better ride with that patient if you've just taken those few minutes and kind of pre-poed everything.
Absolutely. Yes. 100%. 100%. And, if you have the ability to bounce this off of another provider, whether they're a fellow doctor, a fellow paramedic, a nurse, another provider, a combat life service, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And bounce these ideas to be able to, as you said, walk through that problem list. What do you think about this? And I think you're right. A stitch in time saves nine, and you anticipate and you prevent any time that you physically can. Absolutely. I 100% agree.
Yeah. I mean, Murphy jumps on you is the moment you didn't think of something. And that's just I found that if I prepare for something, generally it never happens. And I look just like I'm worried about everything, right? But, yes. Mentioning reaching out and talking to somebody, how is the telemedicine, have you gotten a fairly robust system? Is it very sporadic?
We do not. I do not have access other than who I am either receiving a patient from or providing a patient to. I do not have access to a higher care provider. Having said that, we use digital communications between echelons of care for the purposes of patient information. We have a nice little standard operating procedure of the information that's supposed to be provided. However, you may not have access, to enough time and technology, and there's a lot of jamming and cyber warfare taking place here, so we don't have access necessarily to write out this nice long-winded report. We also have to have everything in two languages, in English and in Ukrainian. So what we have done as well, not only just putting it in if you do have time, sometimes you can do it for a colleague. So if you're sending a patient with two other colleagues on the road, you may stand back and you're waiting for another patient, and you can actually send that information with all the clinical details and interventions and vitals when they left with an ETA, and you can send that to the group for, you know, further in the rear. What also works is a voice file. So you can put it all into a voice file and send that voice file. And then even if it is in the wrong language, you have some time to get a little bit of a translation to be able to kind of walk through, okay, this is what we think is coming in, or this is what we've sent them, and that they have to then, you know, prepare, whether it's for additional surgical interventions or just you know, further stabilization at a role two, with the idea of getting them further in the rear to a role three. So when it comes to telemedicine, really that's what we've seen. That's what I've seen, I should say, as it relates to, you know, really seeking additional support and guidance. I do provide medical direction for partner forces as well as for others that are asking for clinical support and advice, really as it relates to transport decisions. Standard operating procedures being what they are, it provides a lot of advanced direction as to what needs to be done in the pre-hospital space. And really, when it comes to telemedicine, we really use it for communication between echelons of care currently, although that may expand as this warfare evolves.
Right. So you're really just optimizing that asynchronous type telemed.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, absolutely.
All right, very good. And that, obviously that's working out as at least it's providing some information and forehand knowledge of patients, at least get you a little bit more up to speed.
Yes, and it's also helpful with allocation of resource. I mean, if you've got only so many trucks and you say, wait a second, you're sending me two patients, don't move, wait one, and we're going to get you another patient so that you can be full before you make a move. And that's, you know, allocation of resource when it comes to transport vehicles, as well as, hey, wait a second, we have X amount of blood, or hey, wait a minute, we only have so many X-fix for surgical interventions. We need, we know what's coming in. Now, the fog of war being what it is, sometimes that information is completely garbled and completely upside down and backwards, but we do have a bit of an advance warning if we do receive those messages. Yes.
So let's say somebody is coming to you, they want to, from Europe or wherever, what advice would you give them as far as preparing before they get there?
I think it's very important to understand the risk. I think there are a lot of excellent practitioners, doctors, paramedics, nurses, combined advanced practitioners that may be used to a different contracting sort of world or a different type of humanitarian response. This is a extreme conventional multi-domain battle. It is horrible. It is horrendous. It is not been seen since World War II. And so the risk is severe. The challenges are severe. The dynamic, the layers of complexity are extreme. And I think it's very important to understand that for anyone that would like to engage and provide, medical needs and support in this environment. That's at a sort of a broad level. At a very practical level, I think it's important that to bring your own medical equipment, to bring adequate personal equipment so that you are able to sustain yourself for about 3 days without any access to logistical support. Being able to provide your own, protein bars and everything else, no showers, et cetera, and no running water for some period of time. I think that's very important at a practical level. As well as to understand how you link in and how you plug into the system. The Ministry of Health and Ministry of Defense are at war. The whole country is at war. So it is a challenge. It is a ethical, moral, legal, financial, and logistical challenge to come to Ukraine to provide support. It is extremely difficult. It is greatly needed, and the support is well accepted. And the host nation are extremely gracious about receiving support and advanced levels of care. But it is very difficult. It is very risky to travel to a lot of these locations. When you're at a lot of these locations, it is very dangerous. And if you're not prepared for that, it can be detrimental to the rest of the team and to the patients you're trying to provide that to. If you don't really truly appreciate that risk, I think from a cyber warfare perspective, it's very important to understand that you are now a target. You can be the greatest doctor in the world providing life-saving surgery. You are a target. You are target number one. And so that is very important to understand that healthcare in danger, the concept from ICRC about healthcare in danger, it is very real, and it is well evidenced here as to the targeting of all healthcare professionals and doctors specifically. There are thousands of examples of what took place, not only in Mariupol and in Kyiv, but elsewhere throughout this conflict. So I think this is a significant risk that really needs to be understood prior to deployment, whether it's for a few weeks or whether it's for many months.
Good. So that's more of a individual, person to person. What about, other NGOs, which I'm sure there are several that have gotten into Ukraine? If a NGO was moving in, I guess, where and doing what would best help the people of Ukraine?
I think the best people to answer are the Ukrainians. The Ukrainian Ministry of Health, the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Interior. There's a lot of money. There's millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to be spent, and it needs to be spent, and it needs to be invested into these infrastructure to provide healthcare services and support. But the best people to tell you where the needs actually are found in Ukraine. So it's sometimes how do we take this circle and make it fit into a square and vice versa? But really listening, I think sitting down and listening and saying, well, this is what we have. Can this be used? Is this helpful? And they may say, no, actually, for us in this area, we don't need that. Okay, no problem. I'll knock on another door in another region, and we'll see if that is needed there. And really listening to what Ukraine has to say of what their needs are. They know what their needs are best. There is a lot of challenges. There's certainly a lot of personalities to overcome, of course, like every country in the world. But in Ukraine, they can answer that question the best. And they are willing to sit down and engage with partners and say, look, this is what we need. This is how we need it. Can you help and provide this level of support? And then plugging into that, supporting that, this is the best way for engagement, I think, in Ukraine right now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think all too often people try and force their will and the things that they want to do on somebody else, and that always ends up making things a lot harder.
Yes, absolutely.
So kind of closing up, is there anything else that you would like us to know about what's going on in Ukraine and best practices?
Absolutely. I blood. It is a challenge. There is anecdotal evidence from 2015 and 2016 of the use of pre-hospital plasma. There is a lot of access to O-negative blood. Right now, as we speak, the Ministry of Health is engaging with partners in North America and Europe to really support the production of and the legal use of low titer O group whole blood. And this needs to be pushed and driven, and it's an all hands on deck. We need to encourage best practices. The Ukrainians know this is best practice. They want to learn it. They want to get it into the hands of the people that will use it most and best. And this is still a challenge to overcome. And the Ministry of Health is taking a lead on this, and this is great. And I think this is something that from the Department of Defense CPGs, it is well evidenced in the literature. And I think multiple subject matter experts throughout North America, as well as in Europe, need to encourage encourage this and drive this and keep pushing this so that the Ukrainians can really receive absolute best practices in damage control resuscitation. And I think this is something that we're not there yet. I think we're coming there. We're getting there. This has been a nut to crack for a long time. And we can finally see light at the end of the tunnel. And I think this is something that every, you know, this is all hands on deck. Really push this into the space. Get this out there and really have, really get this into the right hands of the right people for damage control resuscitation. That's the most important thing as it relates to the innovation and the new stuff. This is what's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really hope that this gets pushed forward for a variety of reasons, but definitely currently just being able to get best practices as close to the X as possible. As far as the blood that is available, how is storage of it? How is that, have you run into any issues with that?
I have not. A lot of the pushback has been saying, well, we can't store it. Well, you can. And a lot of places right now have moved refrigerators right up into the resuscitation bay in Ministry of Health facilities. And so, big and small, there are the blood bank, the blood group, the blood bank system is really centralized. We need to start shifting a lot of blood from point A to point B so that we can get more of O negative access right now in the immediate, meaning today. However, when it comes to the storage and moving it and logistics, there's a lot of lessons that can be learned of how they've overcome a lot of these challenges, but also as relates to best practices, there's a lot of information that can be exchanged and say, look, this is how this was done. And yes, it's unfortunate that this may not be completely readily accessible. There's a lot of technology involved, but there are ways to overcome and sort of low tech. And I think Ukraine has a lot of things to offer of what it's done so far. I think, understanding, really truly understanding. I think, the Thor group, the trauma hemostasis oxygenation, research network, I think they really have produced so much incredible data to really truly understand all of the logistics relating to access to whole blood and really what will and will not work in the pre-hospital environment and in the austere environment. So I think really going to that and using that and being able to apply those principles here in Ukraine is really needed. And additionally, just to could sort of to move on into additional lessons learned and lessons shared, I think what is absolutely vital, and this has been the case since 2014, is the sharing of information from this warfare. There have been a lot of lives lost. There have been many lessons learned. Unfortunately, there are lessons lost. We cannot let that happen ever again. And we need to share these lessons. We need to share these lessons with all partners and be able to truly understand what worked, what didn't work, what low-tech solutions actually had amazing outcomes and really reduce morbidity and mortality in ways we never dreamed. We need to really press and we need to listen to these voices of actually absolute incredible practitioners that are practicing right now. They don't have time right now to share, obviously, but when they, we really need to encourage that information share, that information gathering and that lessons learned and lessons shared environment with our colleagues. And this is absolutely an incredible opportunity for all partner forces, for NATO and for Department of Defense, certainly, to be able to really gain significant insight from the Ukrainian experience.
Yeah, I mean that's such a big part, and is going to be so helpful, just in care altogether, all the way around, is just that documentation and lessons learned. We have that exact problem too, especially after conflict. We lose all that information because people leave and they keep all those little nuggets to themselves, and so that's part of the reason why we have this podcast is so that we can save and archive that type of information for future use. So if you are willing, I'm definitely more than happy to be a conduit to at least save information, if not post it, at least save it for others to learn from.
with Kizik Hands-Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Absolutely, 100%. Absolutely. And a shout out, actually, to the NATO, Military Medical Center of Excellence out in Budapest. They're trying to really drive and push a lot of the lessons learned from pre-hospital medicine, in addition to other partners throughout Europe and North America, as well as the Thor Network, certainly, really trying to get this information shared and really engage and to provide an environment where people have, providers have, free open access to share this information. So I second that, and I think that's excellent.
Perfect. So this stuff I didn't plan on including into the podcast, but one of the things that myself and the podcast and Abrik is trying to get some of our educational content, either podcasts or videos and things like that, get those translated into Ukrainian. What other languages, if you were going to try and cover, the Eastern Bloc, what would be the other high-yield languages that should be translated, information should be translated into?
Polish, Romanian, Hungarian, Slovak, and Ukrainian. These are the big ones, I think. You can go further on. I think additionally, English, a lot are really focused on English. But when it comes to the acute, as it relates to this focus, really looking at Polish and Romanian are big ones. Having said that, the aggressor, the attacker, the bad guy is Russia. Right. However, there are a lot of Russian speakers in Ukraine. There are a lot of Russian speakers in Moldova. There are a lot of Russian speakers in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, as there are English speakers in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Really considering and really focusing on Polish and Romanian would be a big move forward. And the readership in English and the listenership in English is also quite large.
Okay, perfect. Would there be any areas, obviously blood and resuscitation with blood, but would there be any other topics that you feel are needed?
Topics as it relates to additional conversation
training classes, like just packages that I could get translated and hang in a very public place, so that anybody and everybody that wants them can go in and get that and augment training, because it's going to have to be asynchronous.
So damage control resuscitation, CPG, mm-hmm. pre-hospital blood, CPG, and more, additional information as it relates to damage control surgery. A lot of surgeons that are performing damage control surgery right now are OBGYNs. There is a stomatologist, a dentist, a MaxVax, surgeon. Now they're performing laparotomies. So additional information as it relates to best practices within damage control surgery would be very helpful for that cross specialist, that non-general surgeon, that non-trauma surgeon that's now been pulled into surgery, scrub in and either help perform this laparotomy or do this laparotomy. I think this is something that open laparotomy. I think this is something that would be of significant benefit, and there would be a very high yield for this.
All right, perfect. I can work on that very quickly. I've done some with abdominal packing, I can get with one of the surgeons here, and like Stacy Shackelford or somebody, and to go over principles of DCR.
Well, she's absolutely amazing, absolutely, and being able to get behind her with a lot of best practices is fantastic. I mean, she's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very thankful that she doesn't outwardly say I'm an idiot. So, so other than DCR, are there any other topics like crush syndromes or anything like that?
Well, because we're seeing such an uptick in the number of traumatic brain injury, I think really clearly understanding that pathophysiology, and really in the last 8 years, there's been a expansion of understanding that pathophysiology, understanding what best practices for diagnostics, as well as the sequelae. So I think traumatic brain injury as it relates to percussive injuries and thermobaric weapon systems, which are being deployed here a lot, I think that would actually be very beneficial. I mean, a lot of walking wounded are all traumatic brain injury from blast. So that would probably be very helpful, because I think there's not really a focus on the sort of best practice stepwise fashion of diagnostics, of, you know, understanding the sequelae and understanding the long-term, you know, the issues that may arise, and also best practices for treatment, obviously.
Right. No, again, too easy. Van Wyk, neurointensivist. We've had several podcasts with him about TBI and best practices, pre-hospital anyway. We haven't gotten into like burr holes or anything like that, but definitely pre-hospital, we've covered quite a bit.
Amazing. That's awesome. Yes, that would be very helpful.
So DCR, TBI, anything else? What else can I give you?
I mean, those are the big ones that come to mind. If anything else pops up, I'm happy to follow up. I could actually ask some colleagues later this evening. But I mean, that's obviously they could use the whole gambit, you know, the whole zip file of CPGs. But having said that, I mean, those are the big stuff. That's the big stuff that really comes out. I mean, the emergency war surgery 2015 or 2018, I can't remember which one was translated, which was great. The most recent one that's out, I don't think has been translated yet, although there was kind of a process to try to do that. But that's the big stuff that comes to mind. I think Okay. Actually, you know, as it relates to antimicrobial guidance and antimicrobial stuff relating to surgery and every, you know, it's very difficult with different geography and different locations, but that would actually, you know, from a antimicrobial pharmacovigilance standpoint, that may be very helpful as well.
Okay. Have you, one, I know for a fact that the T-TRIC guidelines have been translated into Ukrainian. An easy button answer, if you're able to get on the internet, which obviously you are, is deployedmedicine.com. And so they have all the T-TRIC and all the CPGs and just about anything else they can shove onto that website.
It's an amazing resource. Yeah, I dump that into everyone. I send that link to three different people every day.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, oh, it's the best. It's the best resource. I mean, we download all the videos. We're trying to get those videos for blood translated into Ukrainian. There's a lot of the stuff that goes to YouTube, and there's some like auto, like AI sort of translation stuff that happens. But that absolutely the best resource that we use every day, literally every day.
Yep. Also, if you didn't know, on the Prolonged Peel Care website, you can easily get there's just one click button, and it just downloads literally every paper and cheat sheet and things like that we have as well.
Definitely. Yes. I haven't been to that website in a few weeks. I need to go back and I think I've downloaded those in the past, but I need to go and make sure. Absolutely.
Yep. Perfect. Perfect. Well, that's it for me. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this?
From my side, I truly appreciate the opportunity. Longtime listener, first time caller. It was awesome to engage with you guys. I mean, absolutely honored to be interviewed, and I think what you guys are doing is fantastic. And really, I encourage it and I support it 100%.
No, the honor is mine for certain. I was excited for quite a while to get a chance to talk to you, and I'm stoked that it finally happened.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Great boy is waiting there for you.